Howdy, y'all.
I'm Leslie.
I'm Laurie. Welcome to
Sumo Kaboom.
Sumo Kaboom.
Where we talk about all things sumo.
That's right. And this week, we are here to celebrate the life of Akebono, who passed away about a week ago. Mm-hmm. And as of recording today, they just had a funeral service mm-hmm. in Japan mm-hmm. to celebrate his life. Mm-hmm. So we talked to people who knew him. Mm-hmm. We talked to people who grew up with him. And we are going to share some of those stories that people shared with us so that we can all get a better sense of who he was.
Yeah, and celebrate his life. But first, a news flash. Thank you to all of you who have reached out and let us know who all of your sumo media is and awesome people for us to follow online and to get all the latest pictures and videos from all of the people in Japan and elsewhere who are submitting content for all of us to view with our eyeballs. We really appreciate all of those tips. We've learned about quite a few more people, and we're super excited about that. One person who reached out actually is Emilienne Greneau, who you may probably see Emilienne on Twitter, but they are starting a website, a daily website in French and English about sumo. So go ahead and look up that. That's Furan Sumo, F-U-R-A-N-S-U-M-O, or follow on Twitter, Emilienne Greneau, and you can find out more information.
We also had some listeners send us messages and say, hey, on Twitch, there's this group, Midnight Sumo. You should be following them. They put up great content. So if you are a Twitch person, look them up. We also had a lot of people mention Twitter.
Yeah, I'm always on Twitter because
I'm rarely on it.
Okay. Yeah, I'm always on it because it's full of cool sumo stuff.
I only get on it during the basho and only just a little bit here or there to sort of take a dip in the pond and then get out as fast as I can. But there are some great folks on Twitter. Tim Sumo is a great person to follow. Yes. Patricia Dobashi is great to follow. Sarah Loves Sumo, one of our favorites. Yep. She always posts great photos of her with all the wrestlers. Sumo Follower is fabulous. Yep. Tachi Eye Blog is great. And there's one I had never heard of, Kata Tsukashi.
Yeah. Seen that one. Yeah.
So there's some Twitter content for you if you want to follow them. Another person that was brand new to me, Polly Esther Pants.
Yes, I've seen Polly Esther Pants occasionally, which is the greatest handle ever.
Yes.
But yeah, like Twitter seems to be like alive with little clips of daily things. Like you just saw one that was
the Fertility Festival. Which we're going to look up perhaps for next week because there's a lot of things I need to find out about this fertility festival.
Yes.
Speaking of really enjoyable photos, someone also mentioned, hey, on Reddit, the Sumo Memes group is really great. And I had forgotten about them.
Yes.
So yes, go look up Sumo Memes thread on Reddit. Also on Telegraph.
Yeah, Telegram.
Telegram. That's right, Telegram. I'd never been on Telegram, but supposedly Nato Sumo moved over to Telegram.
Right. So
we'll have to look that up.
That.
Yeah, so just some other options.
Yeah. Also, I had the pleasure of going to the Roller Town Showdown, which was amateur sumo for all of us stateside people and
international sumo.
And Goose from Salt City came from Australia. So,
well, he's not the only one that came from out of the country.
There are a lot of people that were there. And so I went on Friday to watch Keiko, and it was huge compared to last year. So congrats to Dallas Sumo Club and Corey Morrison, who's put together these incredible tournaments, people from all over. I chatted with so many people, and I creepily stared at Gagamaru and like from a distance. And then I had a quick moment to say awkwardly to Yama-san that I would love to have him on the podcast. So if we can get a translator out there, which I talked to some people there that speak Japanese. So hit me up if you could offer up your translation services. I would love to chat with Yama-san about sumo. Congratulations to all of the wrestlers who competed. The event, I think, went off like without a hitch. I just love the spirit of amateur sumo in like that's happening. It's growing. Thank you for introducing yourselves, letting me watch the Keiko. It was awesome, and I'm inspired by all of your talent. Another thing, if you want to go and watch some sumo, Kiseibeya now has their own YouTube channel. And I stayed up till 1 a.m. last night listening to Hida Noumi be the chatty Cathy that he is. I had no idea that Hida Noumi was the chatty Cathy of the stable, but it's another really great slice of life podcast, or not podcast, video documentary series that you can just watch what happens in their daily life. You get a lot of Ura, and Ura is not chatty, but he's smiley, but he just kind of stands there. And I just am fascinated with it. But they answer questions online, and I know we have a lot of international, they have a lot of international viewers, so it's really cool. So if you want to check that out, that's also really amazing.
That's on YouTube?
Yeah, it's on YouTube. And lastly, we'll go back to the event of this week, which is unfortunately the passing of Akebono, also known as Chad Rowan, Chad George Haheo Rowan. He was the 64th Yokozuna, the very first foreign-born Yokozuna. He was born in 1969 in Waimanalo, in that's Oahu in Hawaii. He joined sumo in 1988. He joined the Azumuzeki stable under the great Takamiyama, who was also a Hawaiian wrestler who found himself in Japan and had excelled and now had his own stable. If you want to listen to a little bit more of the beginning of his life and how he came into sumo, we have an episode, episode 20,
way back when.
Who knows what we were talking about? I'm sure half of it's inaccurate because we've done over 200 episodes. So,
yeah.
I mean, I always am hesitant when I listen to those early episodes because I was like, I think we just don't even know what the heck we're talking about. But we talk a little bit about his beginnings.
And it is interesting that in episode 20. That was early on for us.
Oh, very.
And I wonder why we picked Akebono to talk about so early.
Well, he was such a huge part of me coming into the sport. I came into the sport in 1998 when I was in Japan. I saw him wrestle. This was during the era of Akebono as Yokozuna, Musashi Maru as Yokozuna, Wakanahana, Takanahana rivalry with the Hawaiian wrestlers, and it was huge. There was this media frenzy, and for me, I was an American in Tokyo, and I was watching an American on TV at the highest level of the sport. So for me, he's always been my number one, and I've always craved, you know, doing this podcast, talking to him, but we know now, you know, he's been sick for a really long time. He is closer to our age. He passed away at age 54, like really young, of heart failure. And it brought to light also just how incredibly difficult the sport is on someone's body. He was a huge guy. And of course, we've seen in all the videos how these guys train with the food and everything like that and the stress they put on their body. But post sumo career, he had another 15 years of pro wrestling. And so his body, for all of those years, he used it. And he was such a dignified guy. He was so respectful. You know, he probably made money as a Yokozuna, but I don't think anybody would ever say it ever equals out his fame with what he gave to the sport, how he gave his body completely to sport, essentially. And one of the things that was mentioned in the funerals and the quotes and things that were said this week is that he had been on painkillers from the very beginning. Like when he was 8 years old, he had a meniscus tear. He had some sort of surgery way back then in his childhood. He played sports, basketball. He was the center of the basketball team. He went on in college on a scholarship, but he'd been playing sports with this terrible injury and had always been plagued by that. And by the time you're a Yokozuna, you're on so many painkillers. Konishiki said it. It's like, no, there's not one bone in your body that hasn't been broken. And that stress on his body continued probably into his mixed martial arts career. And he was that those painkillers, they do a lot to your heart. He had a cardiac event, I think, in 2017 or 18, and initially reported that it was not heart-related, but he was in an induced coma for 2 weeks. And then after that is really what took the downturn, and it's been painful ever since. So now that his spirit is free of pain and his family is in mourning, we want to respect that and not to talk too much more about that and move into kind of who he was. One of the descriptions: beloved, dignified, and kind. He was 6'8". So he was enormous. And there was a lot of worry in the very beginning with his coach that he eventually, you know, the Takamiyami, who went to his stable. They thought, this guy's long legs are never going to help. He's going to be top heavy, easy to topple. And he was. But what he did for himself is learn how to have the overreach, the things that you see Tadano Nofuji use, some of these techniques. And he kind of created his own style utilizing his height. Now, he hated the shorter guys.
As they all do.
But his main rival was Takano Hana. The wrestlers, they have a spirit of hatred towards each other while they're rivals. But it seems like in retirement, well, Takano Hana was quoted as saying, I became friends with him. And he's such a dear friend to me and such an incredible part of each other's lives to be able to be rivals like this and to continue to have sport at that level with somebody else that can meet you there. He, as a Yokozuna, was an incredible example, but even in his retirement, see, I forgot about this. He was a coach for a little bit, and he actually helped raise up Asa Shoryu, which I did not realize. He was the one who actually showed him the Dojo Iri when Asa Shoryu became a Yokozuna.
Wow.
So there was a short period of time after he was retired, the pain just, you know, wouldn't go away, and it was just time. He retired, and then in this interview he did with John Gunning that I watched, mentioned that he had asked at that time, will I ever have the opportunity as a stable coach to become the chairman of the JSA? And the answer was no. And that's, again, another brutal part about being a foreigner in this sport. They allowed him to be the very first foreign-born Yokozuna because he had the Hinkaku. But even that followed him later. So he left the sport and his career went in different ways. And then in the pro wrestling world, you can't imagine the storylines. They're like soap opera storylines. But he did that for 15 years in so many different leagues, performing as Akebono. And so half of his career was a lot of that, which I just didn't pay attention to because I wasn't as interested in that. But his career after that was huge in that way. He just kept reinventing himself and never giving up. His style in the ring was mostly pushing thrusting because of those long arms. He could just beat you to it because his arms were so friggin' long. His wingspan was 6'8". I mean, like, enormous.
Yeah. So think of Hokuseiho is about that same height.
Yeah.
And though Hokuseiho is gone and retired, right, and we're not going to see him again, think about that height, but like twice as wide and way, way more aggressive.
Right.
And yeah. Think about how terrifying that would have been in the ring.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And he had such a mean scowl, but when you saw him smiling, it was just like the most sweet, loving smile, and everyone seemed to adore him. But the one thing that's interesting, he grew up kind of poor in Hawaii, and the oldest, I think, of three brothers. And in episode 20, we mentioned the kind of genesis of how he got to the stable in Japan. But that kind of dogged, that sort of like determined spirit kind of mimics what we see from the Mongolians. Like, you can't ever go back home unless you make it. And he always had that spirit about him. I'm going to make it, but then take care of the people around me and send money back home and take care of the ones that he loved. And he was the epitome of that. You may remember him from the Nagano Olympics. He did the Dojo Iri in front of millions and millions and millions of people. And
That was my very first introduction to sumo. But it was one of those like, oh, yeah, I remember watching that way back then and thinking, wow, that guy looks powerful, doing it in front of the world.
Well, and he was the understudy because it was supposed to be Takanohana.
Mm.
So their rivalry continued, but Takanohana got sick. And so even in that, they were trying to put forward a Japanese wrestler first, mm-hmm. in front of the world, but it ended up being Akebono, who is so huge, you mm-hmm. know, 6'8". I mean, I love the way it ended up in that way.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, he's so powerful in this presence.
And you can watch that on YouTube, y'all. Yeah, absolutely. Pull it up if you haven't seen it.
Absolutely. He left behind 3 children and a wife and many, many, many friends. Konishiki, Wakanohana, Takemisa Kari was one of his, I believe, tsukibitos. And so he was at the funeral, and it was a smaller funeral. But many of them had such warm, incredible, wonderful things to say. And they were all so moved by his death at such a young age. I think everybody believed he was going to somehow make it through again. And his body will be cremated, and half will be in Japan and half will go to the seas of the island coastline in Hawaii, where he is from. Because he is a man of Japan, he is a man of Hawaii, and he bridged these two cultures, these two people, in such a beautiful, beautiful way. Here's to the next path beyond the great American Yokozuna. He won 11 tournaments. Lots of gold stars, lots of runner-ups, lots of technique and fighting prize award, all kinds of distinguished awards. I think, but most of all, he won in our hearts, especially for those that are international fans who love the sport and maybe don't see themselves at all recognizable on the screen when we watch it. For him, he created a place for all of us to kind of belong. He and Konishiki and Takamiyama before them, but as the first foreign-born Yokozuna, that was pretty huge for all of us.
As expected, tributes started pouring in this week about Akebono, and I wanted to start the section of our podcast by sharing one that came in from Kelly Oldfield. And she wrote us and said, "My story about Akebono is not very exciting. I was in Japan as part of my university degree, and a friend's homestay family took us to see sumo live at the Kokugikan, and I was totally hooked. My homestay family managed to get me in for morning training at Azumazeki Beya, and I met Akebono after his training session. It was 30 years ago, so I don't remember exactly what we talked about, but I did remember we spoke in both English and Japanese, because at the time we were more used to speaking Japanese and everyone else there was Japanese. And he took the time to chat with me, which was really nice of him. I guess being tall and young and blonde has some perks. As I was leaving, he sent one of his tsukibito to come and ask for my phone number. And he called me a few days later, but it was my last night in Japan with my homestay family, so we never met up. I really wish I had now. That would have made for a better story. Anyway, I was a big fan after that and have had his Tagata all this time. It was sad to hear the news of his passing."
Must have been in his single days.
It must have been.
I love it.
I'm sure he had the pick.
I'm sure he had the pick of the litter, yes.
Yeah, so he could choose anyone he wanted to date, I'm sure. But I thought that was a really sweet story.
Yes.
She sent us a picture, and of course, yes, she's beautiful. She's young and she's blonde, and he's smiling as he's looking at her. So you can see, oh, there's a little spark there. Oh. So thank you for sending that in, Kelly. I had the pleasure this week of calling and talking to people who knew Akebono as Chad.
Right.
Who knew him before he became Akebono. That's really what interested me, and I wanted to share some of the stories that people shared with me over the phone. So some of the stories you're going to hear in the people's voice, the audio quality is over the phone, so it's not as good. But some of these stories I'm just going to share, because either they didn't want to be recorded or the quality of the phone call is really poor at that moment. One of the people that I got to talk to this week was John Jax. Mm-hmm. And we have talked to him on our podcast before. John is known as one of the fathers of American sumo. We have another episode on it. Just, you know, search for John Jax on our website. You'll find out more about him. But he shared with me some really great stories about who Chad was.
I think the story I would like to share about Chad is he always stayed close to his Hawaiian roots. You know, once he got to Japan, and he really struggled for a couple of years to try and figure out if he was really going to be in sumo or not and stay there. And Jesse got frustrated a few times, and they just weren't sure what was happening. Then all of a sudden, he just kind of turned on and just shot up the ranks. But all the time, when the times were tough, and then once the times started getting a whole lot better, and then all the way through his Yokozuna years, he always stayed just this nice homeboy when he'd come back to Hawaii. And he loved to come back to Hawaii. You know, he would come whenever he got the chance. And he had so many friends over here. And, of course, once he became famous, he got a lot more friends. But he just was the kind of guy that was fun to be around. And when I took my Kahuku High School sumo team, we took 20 boys to Japan for 2 weeks in the mid-90s. I forget exactly what year it was. Late 90s. And Jesse talked me out with a whole bunch of people in Japan that I was friends with, Onishiki and all of those guys, said, you know, we'll help you guys out and stuff. And I said, you know, we're coming. Nobody's got money. I work in a very poor school district. Everybody's kind of underwater as far as money goes. And I was bringing 20 of them, but I just wanted them to get the experience and maybe have a couple more get a chance to go. So when we got to Tokyo, somebody picked us up by bus and brought us to Azumazeki Bay. And we got there, about 1 o'clock. And Chad and Jesse walked out the front door, the shoji door, and waited for us as we got off the bus and greeted us. And the kids just were tripping, like, oh, my God, that's Akebono. Because by that time, he was all over Hawaii news. I mean, you could not turn on TV any night that there wasn't an Akebono story somewhere. And these kids, all Polynesians like he was, and they were just, you know, he was like their role model, idol, hero kind of guy. And he went to a high school, just about 20 miles away from the high school our kids went to on our side. And he grew up kind of poor. They didn't have a whole lot of money, and our kids all grew up poor. So they could really relate to Chad. And he brought them in, and he hadn't eaten lunch, so he waited till they got in there to eat lunch with them, because Jesse had lunch all ready to go, chunk manabe and a whole bunch of other things. And then about an hour or two later, I could hear him laughing, and I was sitting with Jesse kind of talking about the plans with the boys and how we're going to work, where we're going to sleep, what we're going to eat, training, et cetera. So I didn't want to mess things up. And I hear all this laughing and stuff from the other room. I said, what's that? They were all in by the sumo ring, but there's that little wooden platform. The 20 boys and Chad, just those guys, 21 people sitting in there, just telling stories and just laughing and teasing each other. The two high schools were rivals, and Chad played wrestling. He wrestled a couple of years at that school, freestyle. He wasn't a good wrestler, so his last 2 years, he switched to basketball. So they were just teasing each other and taunting a little bit just for fun. And all those guys that went to Japan, Konishiki, Musashi, Mato, Chad, all the other 20 Hawaii guys, if somebody from Hawaii came over to Japan, they were just ecstatic, you know, and people bring obiagi like Spam and just all the food. Boy, all the things you can't get in Japan that the local kids grow up with. So we all had dinner at the stable, just simple dinner. And then Chad said, he said, I'm taking the boys up to my room, because Jesse told me, he said, Chad doesn't like people coming to his room. He had like a triple room because it was the Yokozuna up top on the highest floor. And about 4 TVs and all kind of electronic equipment and game. I mean, you know, he's a millionaire Yokozuna, so he could have anything he wanted. And Jesse said, oh, he said, Tommy, you want to keep the boys out of there. I said, okay. So I was going to tell them about that. And then Chad just yells out. He goes, I'm taking the boys upstairs to my room. He said, no coaches allowed. So Chad and 20 high school boys went into his room, closed the shoji doors, and all night long, all we could hear was laughter and roaring. And Chad had his skibido, you know, the lower rank pro wrestlers, running to the stores to come back with, like, 80 hamburgers and 4 cases of Coke, and potato chips and then Japanese foods and candies and cakes and treats. And those kids did not come down in the room that Jesse said we're going to sleep in about 3 in the morning. So myself and the other coach were kind of like a little bit pissed off, but we're lying in this room just in the dark waiting for the kids to come back down. And we're not going to pull them away from Bakke and Bono, but it's like we're exhausted. You know, I've got 20 kids, and we got to get up at 6 o'clock for practice, and it's already 3. And they came down and said, "Oh my God, he was so cool. We played Game Boys, and we told stories, we sang songs, we ate so much food." They were just—they couldn't believe that they were with a grand champion. You know, the guy that they idolize on TV. It'd be like being with Michael Jordan or, you know, any of the superstars of any sport. And, I mean, Chad was like the number one guy at that time. And here's all these 16, 17, 18-year-old boys from a little country school in Hawaii hanging out in Tokyo with the Okuzuna all night long. I mean, any sponsor would have paid $100,000 to have that experience. But these were local kids, and Chad's a local kid. They're all Polynesian, so they just had a blast. When I was talking to the boys the next morning, I got them up about 6 o'clock, and they were all tired as much grumpy. I was just talking to them, and I said, you know, we were talking about practice and how practice was going to work out. And I never had a chance to talk with him the night before. Chad took him upstairs. We never saw him again. And 3 o'clock in the morning was too late to have a meeting, so we had a meeting at 6. I told him that things were going to be kind of tough in a pro practice. And one of the kids said, he goes, "Coach," he said, "you know, we've been talking. We don't think that guy's that tough." I go, "Who?" He goes, "Bakke Bono." "What?" He goes, "Yeah, we were like all lying like on his bed and lying on his belly, and he was hitting on that," and they said, "No, he just doesn't feel like he's got big muscles, and he just felt kind of this like this big old guy. He's just so soft, good, like he's so easy and fun and playful. We thought it was gonna be scary, but that," he said, "you know, well, I don't know." I said, "Oh," I said, "you should never tell him that." I said, "But I said, you know, go to practice and you'll see." So they're in the practice room, and they started just doing a lot of exercise, and then they're going with the lowest ranked guys, the Joe Nakuchi, Joni Don guys a little bit. And they were getting their butt kicked by those guys. But, you know, because these are just high school kids. They're not pros. We train twice a week, and the pros train 6 days a week. So anytime Americans go against the pro Japanese, you almost can guarantee that we're not going to win too many matches. So, but the kids are having fun and just enjoying it. And all of a sudden, about 9 o'clock or so, 8:30, the Makusta guys come down. And so they're training with each other, and the kids look at me and they go, "Wow, these guys are tough." I go, "Yeah, they are." They go, "Can Chad beat them?" I go, "Yeah, you know, maybe." And you're just like middle Makusta guys, and Chad's like up at Sanyaku and Yokozuna for a couple of years and beating everybody. So, but I did want to spoil it. So about 9:30, the Shoji screen door slides open, and Chad comes walking in his mawashi, and he looks totally different in his mawashi than it does in the yukata. I mean, he's impressive any time, but to the kids, he came in, and all of a sudden you can see more of his leg muscles and his arms and whatever and his chest. And he comes in, and he just looks over at the guys, and he goes, "You guys." He just points his finger like, "I'm going to get you." And pretty soon they start backing into a corner. And then Chad starts to do his scope, and Chad puts his foot up, and his foot goes like 8 feet high, it seems like, you know, to the kids. They could barely get their feet up to chest high or waist high. And Chad's foot is way up there, boom! And you can almost feel the doyo shake a little bit when he pound his feet. And then he starts hitting on the tempo pole, and you could really feel just the echoes in the building when Chad hits the tempo pole, because that was his big power, was striking with the hand. And all of a sudden, these kids are all like behind me in the corner, literally 20 kids. He's in about 8 square feet, trying to get as far away from him as they could. And I turned around, I said, "So what do you guys think? You think you can still beat him? Or, no, you don't think he's that tough?" Oh. And then he came into the ring, and he took on the Makusta guys, which he does every day. And he flew them into the wall. He flipped them upside down, and he just knocked. And these Makusta guys had no chance. It was like kindergartners against your varsity athlete. I mean, it was just ridiculous how tough and strong Chad was. And these kids were just crying. So then I told Chad, I went over and kind of whispered to him on a break. I said, "My two team captains said that they thought you weren't that tough. They asked me if I thought they had a chance to maybe beat you." I said, "Why don't you call out Ose and Fa'a?" So Chad said, "Okay." He said, "I'd like to take a couple of you guys to practice. Ose." And I was like, "No, I'm good. I'm good. My ankle's right." "Okay, get your hand over." He brings the kid in, and he didn't hurt him, but he told the kid, you know, like Bud Scotty, he said, "You come and just hit me in my chest as hard as you can. So the kid went like two or three times. And he goes, no, come on, hit, bro. So the next time the kid fired out hard, all Chad did was just kind of like just throw his chest at him. He never even moved his feet. He just kind of popped his chest out. The kid did like a double backflip. He bounced back so fast. And then the other guy went, and the same thing went on. And those kids realized how tough a Yokozuna is. And no matter what you think when you're sitting down playing with them, playing video games, that ain't what you see in the dojo. And that was some of the magic that Chad had. And everybody talks about this. In the dojo, he was a beast. He was just a tsunami coming at you, and there's almost no way you could stop it. Outside the dojo, outside the keiko room, he's one of the nicest, funnest guys you could be, unless you really cross him. Then all of a sudden you just see that kind of blank thing come down his eyes. Oh, dude, run. Run. He's not happy. But when he was happy, and he was always happy pretty much, you know, he was not only to our high school boys, but to all the young guys below him, and especially the Hawaii guys that went to Japan, even if they weren't in his stable, he would go and visit them at their stables and talk to them and counsel them and coach them and train them. And in the dojo, I mean, he'd knock the crap out of the Hawaii kids or any kid, but then he would coach you and talk to you about it. And then just if kid was short of money or had a problem or his mom had a surgery or something, Chad would all of a sudden be a $500, $1,000 in the kid's little purse or something after practice. And he was this amazing guy that could kind of turn it off and on. And that's what the beauty of sumo is that these guys can be absolute warriors, but most of them, because of the discipline and the code that they live by, are some of the most honorable, fun-loving, just pleasant, kind-hearted people you can imagine, because they know down in the dirt every morning and every night at tournaments and stuff, it's dog-eat-dog. So when they're not doing that, they want to smell some of that sweet side of life. Especially Chad Yokozuna. He was somebody special. Those are my stories. There's another guy named Bumbo Kalima. There were two Kalima brothers that went to Magaki Beya. And the older brother, George Kalima, ended up being Yamato, and he made it up to Makauchi for quite a few tournaments, maybe, I don't know, 6 or 8 or 10 tournaments. And then health took over, and he had to quit sumo. And he just died like 3 months ago. And he and Chad were really close buddies, they lived about 6 blocks apart. And his younger brother's name, his nickname is Bumbo, B-U-M-B-O, Kalima, because they were all really close. They kind of grew up together, and Chad would come over to the house when he was home, and they'd go over to his house. They knew the mom and dad. Everybody knew everybody.
George and Chad were like thick as thieves growing up. They were best friends. They knew everything about each other. One would do something, and the other one would join in. And so that meant, because that was Bumbo's older brother, he was often in on the game and knew Chad very well as they were growing up. But not only growing up together, but they all went to Japan and they all became sumo wrestlers.
Right.
Now, Bumbo didn't stay in as long because of an injury. He came back home to Hawaii, but he was there during the transition from Hawaii to Japan.
Yeah.
Like, he knew him before, he knew him during, he knew him after. And he really wanted me to understand that Chad was a giver more than anything, and he was a protector. He was the kid that, you know, if somebody got hurt while they were playing at the beach or something like that, he would pick that kid up and he would walk him home carrying him, even if it was 2 miles, right? He was that kid. He was tough as nails. He had a tough life, but he was the provider. He was always the one fundraising for his community. And it was a community in which there was not much money.
Right.
You know, he really took charge. He struggled a lot, but he really took care of everyone around him. He really wanted me to understand that his brother, George, and Chad did everything together, followed each other into new things. For example, his brother George played football, and he talked Chad into playing football with him. But Chad didn't stay with football because he couldn't find the footwear that would fit him. Like, when he was 13 years old, he said Chad had a size 13 foot. When he was 14, he had a 14 size foot. 16 size foot. And so he changed to basketball only because they had the footwear that could actually fit him.
Yeah. And he was big. He was a center.
Right. He was big. He was tall. He told me a story about how he just got home from surfing and Chad called him and said, hey, let's go play basketball. I want to go play basketball with these guys. And so, you know, Bumbo was like, okay, yeah, jumped in the car with him. They drove across the island. And Bumbo only found out when they got there that Chad was like, he was playing basketball, not just with neighborhood kids. He was playing basketball with the top high school guys, the tallest guys, the state champions in Hawaii. And he was dominating. Chad was dominating the whole game. He had this fire in him. He had a drive in him then that was like, I'm going to win. I am going to beat these guys no matter what. And he would just drag Bumbo along to do these things. He told me a story about, because money was tight, Chad had this little bitty car, like this little Nova, and he was so big in
Chevy
this car.
Nova?
Yeah.
Looks like a clown car with
right?
coming out of it.
Yeah. And because money was tight, he never registered the car. And his arms were so long that he used to stick his arm out the passenger side in order to signal that he was going to turn right. Like it was that size. But he said he didn't even have the money to get a license either. So for his prom, for Chad's prom, he had a permit, but not a license, in an unregistered car. And he needed a driver. So Bumbo was his licensed driver. And he sat in the back seat of this tiny little clown car as Akebono drove his date and Bumbo in the back to prom, signaling out both side windows as they drove.
That's hilarious.
Isn't that great?
He seemed like a funny, funny guy.
Yeah.
I saw a clip of him singing some karaoke and just busting up in a club, like in Hawaii. It was like a Hawaiian news clip of one of his friends who Akebono, if he was in Hawaii, would come and see and go to his restaurant. And he just seemed kind of just like a joyful, like center of the kind of party kind of guy.
He was. That's exactly it. Yeah. Bumbo said he loved to tell jokes and he really loved to tease people, especially his good friends. And people loved him for it. He sent us a picture of the day of his going away party, right? He got recruited to go into sumo, mm-hmm. and they had a going away party at the Chuck Wagon.
Amazing.
And they had this dinner, and he said, you know, Chad was very respectful to everyone who came, very respectful to his family, sang them all songs. But in this picture, I mean, he's huge. He was only 6'5" then, but he's already like a head and a half taller than everybody else before he went out. And maybe we'll share that photo because it's a real sweet photo of him right as he left. Now, once Chad got to Japan, Bumbo really wanted me to understand how determined he was. Mm-hmm. He was one of those sumo wrestlers that traveled to other stables to learn from the best. And he said, did you know he got knocked out cold? Like one of the first few times he went to train with Konishiki, he just knocked him out cold, left him on the floor. And Chad woke up as they were sweeping the dojo after practice.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. He said that's how tough training was for him. But he always went to the best stables and just got himself beat up silly to learn from the best and to learn all the different techniques.
Yeah.
And that is what got him to the top.
Yeah.
It was not because he sat on his laurels and waited. It's because he got beat up and he learned.
Yeah. Well, and Konishiki was close to him as well. And he was at the funeral. And I imagine there was probably some sort of Hawaiian spirit between the two gentlemen that was like, in this way, I'm training you so you can protect yourself and understand this is me doing this to you. It will be worse probably from lots of other people. But if I can do it, you can do it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Bumbo really wanted me to understand that he said Chad and my brother George got into a lot of trouble together, but they were really fun to be around. There was never an awkward moment and they always made you feel loved and respected, even in the hardest of times.
Mm.
I also got to talk to Lynn Matsuoka, who's another person we've interviewed on this podcast before. She's a wonderful artist and an ex-NHK commentator who spent a lot of time in Japan making artwork of these guys, hanging around these guys.
In the dressing room, she had personal access for many, many years.
She told me a lot about who he was behind the scenes.
Okay, well, to start, of course, I was going to, you know, Takamiyama, Jesse Kahalua. I was going to his stable a lot, and, you know, we were friends. You know, in my early days in sumo, he was the only one I could talk to because I didn't speak Japanese, and, you know, he was an English speaker. So, but, you know, he was another, you know, really nice, nice guy. So I was very familiar with the stable, and when Chad came along, Jesse asked me if I could please, like, invite him over to dinner as much as possible because, you know, invite him over for hot dog dinners or spam. And he said, you know, just to kind of ease him into the sumo life, he could sit at home because I was married at the time and I had two small children. You know, we could all speak English all evening, and it would kind of make him feel more comfortable because he was like a fish out of water when he got to Japan, you know. He didn't really know what to do or who he was or where he was going. He didn't know much about sumo. So, you know, Jesse said it really helped a lot, and he wound up coming over to my house a lot. And as you said, my kids were really young then. And, in fact, one story I love is, I can't remember their ages particularly, but Jesse was probably about four, and that would make Cora about eight because they're 4 years apart. I asked him to babysit for my kids one New Year's Eve, and he said, sure. So he came over with a couple of his, you know, Desi, a couple of his proteges, young guys. And they hung out and they had hot dogs. And, you know, I had a very American-style apartment with a big fridge and a big kitchen. And they kind of hung out in the kitchen and watched TV and had a good old time. And very shortly after that, Chad became grand champion. So I said to Musashi Maru, when he came along and he was working his way up, you know, through the ranks, I said, when he had gotten to the Makanoichi, the top division, I said, well, you know, why don't you come over and babysit for my kids New Year's Eve? Because, you know, like Chad, if you babysit for them New Year's Eve, you'll probably become grand champion. He said, really? I said, yeah. And, you know, all these guys are really superstitious. So he said, okay, I'll babysit. So he came over and babysat for my two boys, and shortly after that, he became grand champion. I love that story.
Were they excited about it? Or were they just kind of like, yeah, I'll do it for you, for anything? I mean, what was their response?
Well, you know, they were willing to babysit for my kids because they liked coming. I mean, I had, like I said, I had a beautiful American or, you know, European style home with a big kitchen and a, you know, a big sofa they could lay around on and watch TV. It was very, it was like being home more than being sitting around the tatami mats, you know, in a tent in Tokyo somewhere. It was a lot more comfortable for them, more like what they were used to or what they wanted to be used to. And, of course, the place was always stocked with eats and drinks and everything they wanted. So they were very happy there. And they would have done it anyway. But, you know, Chad didn't know we was going to make him Yokozuna. Well, it wasn't, of course. It was just, you know, luck. But I think Musashi might have did it because he was a friend and he would do it anyway. But I'm sure it didn't hurt to think that, well, you know, maybe there's something there. You know, my kids grew up. I brought my kids to – I moved back from New York to Tokyo when Jesse was 2.5 and Toro was just 6. So they grew up in the dressing rooms in the Sakubaya at sumo because that's where I lived when I was in Japan. So they grew up with all these people. As to them, these are totally normal people, and the life then just would be a normal life. So, but to have, you know, the sekitori come over and be a babysitter, that was real cool. Stuff for them to talk about when they went to school, you know. I'm glad I could, you know, you always want to give your kids something special, so there it was. Yeah, but it's interesting that, you know, Chad came to Japan, but Chad didn't really know much, and he was a kind of fish out of water there. But he had such a capacity. He was a really brilliant man. He had a capacity for adapting to whatever was necessary quickly, and I have to say, with aloha. I mean, I have always said, and I have this in my book too, that, I mean, he brought aloha into the world of sumo. And I realized it one day. It came to me, because, you know, I spent a lot of time in Hawaii over the years before he got to Japan. And I was sitting in the, you know, I was sitting in the dressing room next to him doing my drawings, and one day a young they call him No Face, you know, a young guy new to sumo, nobody would know who he was. He walked up the aisle to, you know, past all the guys in the dressing room, and he walked up to Chad because he was, you know, going to say the formal greeting, and he wanted to talk to Chad, so Chad told him to come into the dressing room at a certain time, so he did, and he was very nervous because he's going to see the grand champion, and you know, he didn't know what to do with himself. But Chad wanted to help him because he was having problems and he couldn't afford to buy a kimono or anything, something like that. It was a long time ago and I can't quite remember exactly why. But the guy was a nervous wreck, you know, and he's standing in front of the grand champion, you know, and Chad's sitting there, you know, big guy in his arms crossed and his cutoff is sitting on the edge of the tummy thing. And he talked to him in Japanese so kindly, and he was so sweet and so almost fatherly. And he was telling him that he would help him and he would take care of whatever it was the guy needed and he couldn't pay for because his parents had no money. And he said, don't worry, you know, we'll get together at the end of the week and we'll take care of whatever it was. And he just transformed this young kid, you know, from a scared little boy who was lost because he didn't know how he was going to get them what he needed. And I could see him just be transformed and his face changed and he became relaxed and he was so, I could feel that he became so happy that he suddenly had a mentor, you know. He had somebody who would provide or protect him. I just got this overwhelming feeling at that time that just what he's sharing here is pure aloha that he grew up with, that was embedded in his DNA, and he was sharing it with this young boy, and that's what he brought to everybody around him, everybody who knew him, but just a kindness and a big heart that you can't learn and you can't buy, you know, and very few people have it, and I realized that's what this is, that's what he is, that's what he's all about from that moment on. As I mentioned, at a certain point, when I had this beautiful apartment, at one point it started getting very moldy. I mean, mold was crawling up the walls. It was ruining my clothes. It was starting to affect my artwork. It was horrible. And I finally had to leave. I had to get out of there. I was paying a lot of money. I was paying like $7,000 a month for that apartment. And it was horrible. So I had, you know, I'm prolific when I'm working, and I had a huge collection of work, and I didn't know what to do with it. I talked with Chad, and he said, that's okay. He happened to have a second home, and they didn't live there, but that's where he kept all his trophies and his awards and his extra clothes, whatever, you know, had this big house. So he said, that's all right, move it all into my house. I'll give you a whole corner of the house. So I brought it all over there, and it stayed there for like 2 years before I could put together, it cost me a fortune to ship it to New York.
Wow.
So, I mean, that's the kind of thing he did for his friends. He was magnanimous and generous, and he was there for you, you know, if you were a friend. But I wanted to tell you about, you know, one thing I think, I don't think Christine would mind. Christine is his wife.
Yeah.
And, you know, over the years, all kinds of girls would come by, or their fathers who, you know, their fathers have dollar signs in their eyes, you know, because he's doing well. You know, a lot of girls get married off to top division sumo wrestlers because their fathers see money. So 3 times over a number of years, Chad, I mean, I saw him almost every day, he would say, oh, I met this girl, she's Japanese, and she's really beautiful, and I think I could love her, and maybe I should marry her. And I said, yeah, let me meet her. And I said, okay, listen, this is just my opinion, but I've been here a hell of a lot longer than you have, and I'm telling you, one is my gut feeling, and this is also from my observations. This girl or this woman is not for you because she's after you for the wrong reason. And I swear to you, I would stand by what I'm saying. That would be a huge mistake to marry this woman. And so I put that idea in his head, and he took a look at the situation each time, you know, a little more deeply, a little more carefully, and in the end, she broke up with him. And then one day, he introduced me to a woman named, I think her last name was Rowan, Christine, anyway. She was very short. She's 5 foot eight, you know, 6 foot eight. And she was like 5 foot nothing. You know, really very pretty, very cute, smart as a whip. And don't take no, you know what, from no one. You know, she very feisty, you know, had a very strong personality. But I could tell that she adored Chad. I could tell that, you know, she wasn't, you know, it wasn't like goopy stuff where, oh, well, she's such a favorite. It wasn't that stuff, which the Japanese, you know, the Japanese women were all after. And she wasn't being set up by her dad, by a Japanese father looking for dollar signs. You know, yeah. She really, really cared for him, and he was crazy about her. And I said, you know, she's fantastic because she's got a personality and she'll stand up to you, and that's what you need. And she was cute and smart, and they had a wonderful relationship when they got married. I think they have 3 kids. But I wanted to say that when Tora, my we call him Tora, my oldest son, he was a young teenager. He was becoming difficult, shall I say. Anybody has a son might understand that. He's just getting, you know, ornery. And I would tell Chad about it. We'd talk about it. Chad would come over and talk to him. And one day he said to me, look, why don't you send him over to live with me in a stable for a month, and I'll straighten him out. I said, really? And he said, yeah, she's done that with other, you know, other sons of friends who start getting scrappy or talk back or doing things they shouldn't do. So Tora went to, I said, okay, I said, okay, how about going to live with Chad in a stable for a month? Yeah, okay, well, no problem there. So he went, but he was treated like any kid, though, you know, any slave. Any protege, you know, he had to run to the store and get stuff. He had to clean and wash dishes and wash clothes or whatever they do at the very lowest level of sumo. And I tell you, when he came back home after a month, he was a perfect child. And I said, you know, you should start at school. I mean, this is where you can make money. It was amazing. And I asked her, Eddie Torres, 40 now. And once in a while, you know, I say, well, do you remember living with Chad? He said, oh, yeah. And how did you like it? He said, oh, it's great. I said, don't you remember? There was a lot about it you didn't like. He said, well, yeah, I guess so. But, you know, but he has fond memories because he loved Chad. And both my kids adored him. But he did wonderful things like that, you know.
Akebono's name means new dawn. And so maybe in this new spring or this new dawn or this great beyond, Akebono is now up there with the gods, with his friends past. And hopefully we all carry a little bit of that Akebono spirit with us personally in our own lives, but into the future of sumo, the sport that we love so much and that he gave so much to.
A lot of people spoke to me about how Chad exemplified the aloha spirit.
Right.
A spirit of generosity,
yeah,
of giving, of caring for his family, doing everything he could to support other people. So with that in mind, I'm going to take the memory of Chad with me to encourage me to do the same. And thank you all for listening. We'll speak to you next week.
That's right. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.